oregano.
No, we owe it all to WBAI.
Well, what about the oregano?
We put it on his pizza.
If you owe it all to WBAI, make sure to keep your membership current. For only $25 a year, you will enjoy all the privileges of membership, including the right to vote in WBAI's democratically run elections. And don't forget to sprinkle some oregano on your pizza.
Did you know that when you apply for a job, your credit history may affect your chances of getting hired? And if you already have a job, your credit history can still be used against you. That's because a growing number of employers use credit reports to make hiring and firing decisions. This practice can have a discriminatory impact on people and communities of color and unfairly block many qualified people from employment. Help end this practice by speaking up. If you or someone you know has been turned down for a job or even fired from a job because of credit checks by an employer, please call NIDAS Financial Justice Hotline at 212-925-4929.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words.
Are you too horrified by Trump and the current administration?
Feeling hopeless and fearful for the state of the country?
Looking for ways to fight back or all of the above? Well, we want you to know that there are plenty of ways to resist.
Join the resistance with WBAI. Find out what's happening on WBAI's actions and event calendar at WBAI.org.
Again, for a list of upcoming actions and demonstrations, visit WBAI.org/calendar.php.
Hi, I'm Paul DiRienzo, host of a new program on WBAI, the Thursday edition of Trump Watch, the first 100 days. On Trump Watch, we dissect and inspect the administration of President Donald J. Trump, searching for meaning in the chaos. Tune in every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. following the evening news. Listen while you still can.
Fake news.
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 This fake news was indeed fake news.
Are you tired of fake news? You're listening to The Alternative. It's real news powered by real New Yorkers just like you. This is WBAI 99.5 FM, resistance radio powered by the people. Keep it locked right here.
Here on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay. In today's first interview segment, we're going to be taking a look at 30 years of the ACT UP movement. It's something that had impact around the world to get the powers that be at whatever level of government, local, state, national, international, to pay attention to the AIDS crisis. It's the 30th anniversary this year of the ACT UP movement, and we'll be taking a look at that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week of April 5th, 2017. USA Today reports that President Trump expressed confidence this past weekend, both on social media and the golf course, that he and aides can somehow resurrect their attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Hours before hitting the links with one of his critics on health care, Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, Trump tweeted, quote, "Anybody, especially fake news media, who thinks that repeal and replace is dead does not know the love and strength in the Republican Party," close quote. Trump, who took a political hit last month when House Republicans failed to agree on an alternative health care plan, also tweeted, quote, "Talks on repealing and replacing are and have been going on and will continue until such time as a deal is hopefully struck," close quote. Hours later, Trump, who during his 2016 campaign criticized former President Obama frequently for playing golf, headed to his golf club in Northern Virginia. The White House said the president played a round of golf with Senator Paul and White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. The health care issue generated friction between Trump and some conservative Republicans in Congress. They include members of the House Freedom Caucus, which blocked consideration of a Trump-backed health care bill, saying it did not reduce enough government regulations. The president even took the step of threatening primary challenges to members of the caucus, who said they're not intimidated. CNN reports that Democrats eyeing the 2020 presidential contest could soon face a Medicare for All litmus test from the party's progressive base. After last month's failure of President Donald Trump and congressional Republicans to repeal the Affordable Care Act, progressives are now going on the offense, mounting a new push for a single-payer-style national health insurance program. Leading the way is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, whose megaphone on the left is loud enough to force others vying to lead the party to weigh in too. At a weekend rally in Boston alongside another liberal firebrand, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Sanders vowed to introduce a Medicare for All bill in Congress within a month. Senator Warren herself had already spoken and was off stage by the time Sanders issued his call. However, a week earlier, she was asked at a town hall whether Democrats should pursue adding a public option for health insurance or a single-payer national health insurance program. Yes, she responded, both. Warren's hedged, some saying that Democrats need to wait for the right time. The incident showed that a single-payer national health insurance program, or Medicare for All, as Senator Sanders puts it, is sure to become a gut check for all Democrats. It's long been a policy dream of many liberals, but Democrats who live in states and districts that were carried in last fall's presidential elections by Trump are certain to be sensitive to the political risks of supporting what Republicans call socialized medicine. Still, progressive organizations have begun a major push for the idea last week. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which calls itself the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party, started to circulate a petition last week seeking support for Senator Sanders' proposal, stating that all Democrats on the ballot in 2018 should publicly support and run on passing the plan. The failure of the Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan to shepherd a Republican plan through the House last month is one reason liberals are now mounting a new Medicare for All push. Another reason is that now former President Barack Obama has left the political stage, and that means Democrats don't need to hold back on their critiques. And finally, the website Stat reports that while they've gotten through medical school, applied to residency programs, and been actually offered a job at a U.S. hospital, for some of the nearly 4,000 non-U.S. citizens who graduated from foreign medical schools and who've now won coveted medical residencies in the United States, it's unclear whether they'll actually be able to start to work on time this coming summer. That's because a program that allows employers to fast-track H-1B visa applications for their employees has been suspended. U.S. immigration officials announced the change just a month ago, leaving some hospitals rushing to figure out who needed the kind of visa and to apply before premium processing would no longer be an option. They're battling against the clock, according to Partners Healthcare Office for International and Professional Students, which handles visa applications for international staff and students for Boston area hospitals. The group has been working evenings, weekends, and early mornings to get so-called, quote, premium processing for as many students as possible. This faster turnaround costs over $1,000 per applicant, but it makes a difference. With premium processing, a visa application is answered within 15 days. Without it, the evaluation can take more than 6 months. The change comes on the heels of President Trump's executive orders imposing a temporary travel ban on people from a handful of majority Muslim countries, actions that have been put on hold by federal judges. Some medical students with Iranian citizenship who had been hoping to do their residency training in the United States have now changed their destinations to Canada or European countries, as coming to the U.S. now seems almost impossible, according to Dr. Sanaz Attaripour, a neurology resident at Drexel University in Philadelphia who founded a Facebook group for Iranians applying for American medical residencies. Over a year ago, slightly fewer foreign medical student graduates applied to medical residency training programs. Not all international medical residents come to the United States on an H-1B visa. Most get a J-1, which offers cultural or educational exchange opportunities. However, some either aren't eligible for a J-1 or don't want that type of visa because it requires that you return to your home country at the end of your training and stay there for 2 years. The only way to get around the mandatory trip back home is to work in a medically underserved community, which in turn requires that you get an H-1B visa. Even international medical students who've already come to the American medical schools could be affected. They often use an extension on their student visa for the first year of medical residency training before transitioning to an H-1B for their second year. If residents at any stage aren't able to start work when they're supposed to, that can potentially cause staffing problems for hospitals who rely on them to treat patients. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first interview segment in a moment, taking a look at 30 years of the ACT UP movement. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. On March 24th, 1987, a bunch of people gathered on the corner of Wall Street and Broadway in Lower Manhattan to demonstrate against high pharmaceutical drug prices for experimental AIDS drugs. That was the birth of the ACT UP movement. This year, the chapters across the world are celebrating the 30th anniversary of that movement. And we've got a couple of people here today to talk to us about the ACT UP movement, its beginnings, its history, and what it's working on now. Joining us here in the studio is Andy Velez, who was one of the founders of ACT UP New York, and Ivy Arce, who's here in studio with us. Welcome, Andy and Ivy.
Hi.
Hi.
So, Andy, you were one of the people in that demonstration, but before we talk about that, what gave birth to the whole thing? What got the whole thing going?
Well, what happened was there was a mysterious illness that had been happening for a while that was deadly and carrying off people, and the government wasn't doing anything about it. In fact, nobody was doing much of anything about it except a small group of men who formed the Gay Men's Health Crisis, but that was not really an activist group, and activism was what was needed to really get things going in terms of treatments, housing, a number of very core issues that were affecting the lives of people who were sick.
And so, how did the first demonstration that I just recounted get organized? What brought that about?
Well, Nora Ephron used to say that the greatest contribution she may have made to ending the epidemic was getting sick and not being available to give a speech she was supposed to give at the then Lesbian and Gay Center, now the LGBTQ Center. And so Larry Kramer was a last-minute substitute for it. And Larry gave a characteristically fire-eating speech about how in a short time half the gay men in the room were going to be dead. That galvanized people to start talking about what could we do. And the what could we do, the first demonstration was down in Wall Street against the high price of AZT, which was then the only drug available and was actually a lousy drug. And I was at that first demonstration in Wall Street. My heart was pounding in my chest because I was at the time involved in a divorce action that related to the custody of my children, and I was really worried about being seen and possibly photographed and possibly arrested. But nevertheless, I continued my participation. I wasn't arrested that day. And from then on, I was at every Monday night meeting and various general meeting of ACT UP at the center, which it still meets every Monday night at 7 o'clock. And anyone listening who thinks they might want to participate, come on down. Oh, come on up. And soon I was working on various committees, and suddenly 30 years have passed, and I and we are still at it.
Heidi, what brought you into the ACT UP movement personally?
Well, just to speak of what ACT UP has done for me. So basically, I came to New York in 1990, and taking the subway, I saw a poster of that ACT UP had put as an action, and it was a poster in the subway that said, "Women don't die of don't get AIDS; they just die from it."
So, yes, I remember that campaign.
So this is during a time that women did not get tested, and doctors were not open of women getting tested. So based on that actual poster, I revisit my history, who I had been dating. I had just arrived from Spain. I used to work in Barcelona.
Huh?
And somebody that I dated for a while was a drug user. So based on that action poster, I went and got tested, and that's how I found out. So mm-hmm. That was 27 years ago.
Yeah.
So at the time, I got the blood work back, and doctors didn't know where to send me. So I ended up at ACT UP that same week. And from there on, of course, there was no platform for me to do anything, because all the guys were really out there, really loud.
Literally and figuratively. Yes.
Exactly. So I did go to a couple of the actions in D.C. with them, and including with Peter Staley, which he did not. He may not remember this, but he also had a hard time believing that I was in the right bus. So he would say, "Are you a nurse? You know, are you in the wrong nurse? Are you a pharmaceutical? Are you a cop?" So we did the ashes in D.C.
The ashes action.
Yeah.
That was where people threw the ashes of their deceased loved ones over the White House fence.
Right.
To confront and President Bush. Yeah, the first President Bush.
Yeah. So I was there and made it stayed in the bus, despite of what Peter said.
And just for people who don't know, Peter Staley is one of the main characters, or personalities, I guess, featured in the Oscar-nominated documentary How to Survive a Plague, which documented the early years of the ACT UP movement, particularly the treatment activism part of
right.
that.
So along the way, several of the ACT UP members kind of basically groomed me into working parallel to what we could do. So Tim Horn, who's a TAG at this point.
Which is the Treatment Action Group, the organization, one of the many organizations that sprang off from ACT UP over the years.
So those are they're more research-oriented. They really are on top of the whole HIV and hepatitis. So Tim Horn started this thing called...
And tuberculosis also.
Huh?
And tuberculosis.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Right, yeah.
So Tim was involved with this group called the PW Health Group. So it was one of the first buyers club in New York City. So they started a treatment group for women that only dealt with medication. So I worked with him and Sally Cooper. And at the same time, I was groomed to help like grassroots with like APACHA, which is the Asian Pacific Islander group that works with HIV.
Mm-hmm. And they're still around too?
They're still around, and now they expanded their whole mission where they have a clinic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, especially under the current circumstances, get a lot of their health care and blood work done there.
Mm-hmm.
So then they grew me to be at the planning council, so I did two... I guess
this is the New York City HIV Planning Council, which brings a lot of the social and health service providers together to
from the federal government.
Yeah, the money comes from the federal government under the Ryan White Care Act.
Under the Ryan White, so we did a lot of crafting of medical deliveries and monies from, you know, housing, SNAPs, you know, which is the Medicaid version of, like, that directs...
it's a special health plan under Medicaid for people with HIV, the special needs programs. Yeah.
So that was 4 years of my life. In a very painful situation. And I, along the way, I was very much in touch with TAG for my own situation. You know, and ACT UP also helped me a lot with, because when I got tested, basically, New York, was, even though it was New York, people were not very accepting of women being positive, including I lost my job. I had to, you know, it was all very disgusting, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, 30 years later, and I was very excited to work, to have Reed Reeland close our memorial, somebody that was born positive, and now is 31 years old. I've known him since he was 4. So I think this anniversary was very meaningful in that way.
For many people, yeah. I myself got involved in the ACT UP movement around the same time you came in. It was in 1991, and it completely transformed my life to what I am and do today and host this program and everything. So, and in fact, this program started out many years ago as a program on HIV, AIDS, and activism and treatments and information and stuff started by people before I got involved in producing it. So our roots go back to the ACT UP movement here, this very program, Health Action. Andy,
it's really not possible for people who weren't around to imagine what it was like in those early years, when people were dragging themselves to St. Vincent's Hospital, as that was the main place for treatment at the time, people, mostly men, mostly younger men, but not exclusively, looking like the Walking Dead, with KS all over their bodies and various other manifestations of the virus. And the thing was, at the very beginning, I think many of us thought, this is all going to be over. We just have to get the government busy working on drugs and processing them. And in another 4 or 5 years, it'll be over. But we had no frame of context in which to place what was happening. And so we began to learn a lot about what was going on, that it wasn't, first of all, it wasn't going to be over in 4 or 5 years. And that, and the epidemic threw a spotlight on everything that was broken in our society.
Yes.
Issues around gender, healthcare in general, housing, children, women, and their needs. I can remember once the weekly meetings were a wild experience.
Certainly.
And education. And I remember once a social worker came in and said, because that's people arrived and started telling things that were going on, and working groups would form around issues in the evening. And by the end of the evening, more actions would be planned. And this particular social worker said that he had a client who had an 11-year-old son who was sick and weighed something like less than 80 pounds. And he was trying to get a nutritional supplement for the child, and he couldn't get it approved at his welfare center. So I asked him if he could get a picture of the manager, the case manager, at the center, which he did, and 2 days later we were marching in front of that welfare office with the manager's face on the posters, and we got that kid his, he didn't survive, sadly, but we did get him his nutritional supplement. And that's how ACT UP was, and to a certain extent still is, very much what, just heard about this, what can we do about this? And people start planning things. We've always been, in a sense, ahead of the curve, because the people who knew the most about HIV were those who were and are living with it. And there was a lot of resistance at the beginning from scientific and medical communities, like, you know, who are these interlopers presuming to think they know more than we do? But we did know more than they did. By the way, personally, I got involved not because I thought I was at risk, because I didn't. I didn't think I was doing things that would have put me at risk, but actually I was, as I learned later. But what I thought was that it was so unjust that people should be mortally ill and living with an incredible sense of shame and stigma at the same time, and being shunned by their families, by other people, losing their jobs, in some cases losing their housing. And it just seemed, on top of all of that, so unjust that they couldn't get the one possible medication at the time. And I still have a very strong sense of the injustice in the epidemic. When you're talking about some of the things we're working on now, there's a recently revived youth group within ACT UP. There's a group of us who are working on issues around crystal meth, which is an epidemic of its own and is one of the things that contributes to the perpetuation of the epidemic. And if we're going to
the epidemic, right,
we have to address all these issues.
So let's fast forward now 30 years. There was a 30th anniversary action. We had three components to it. There was a memorial, a march, and a rally. So let's take those kind of one by one. Ivy, you were one of the MCs at the memorial event. Spend a minute or so and let's share with the listeners what that was like.
I thought it was really wonderful because I think...
It was held at the New AIDS Memorial Park here in the West Village in Manhattan.
Yeah, I think...
Which doesn't have a plaque explaining what it is, by the way.
Well, I guess we all have very deep feelings about that whole space. You know, the hospital that's not there, that's an expensive condo, and yeah, we have a park, but we enjoy the park, and it's an amazing sign, I think it's that very bittersweet kind of realization. I mean, I think people that are still here from 20-something years ago feel, you know, we all struggle with the whole survival thing. We struggle with what the past was, and we struggle with the recommitment of coming back. Most of us came back in 2012, I think, by, you know.
Yeah, we did the 25th anniversary with Occupy Wall Street, yeah.
Yeah, and also with the rising infection with young people and having PrEP available, wrapping that, pushing it through once more for the youth. Also...
And in the Black and Latino communities in particular.
Exactly. I think it's also, we all, the long-time people, really have a hard time because we're kind of dealing with people that have forgotten this whole past. And I think we did some, like, I think, hoodies, right?
Yeah.
And we were just talking about even putting just ACT UP, spelling it all out so that people really remember what that was, not just this acronym.
It stands for the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power.
So just to take the opportunity to revisit history, reseal it, and also realize where we are at right now with a very complicated government. We've been able to, you know, have young generations born negative to positive parents. That is not talked about. PrEP, PEP, all that stuff. And where research is happening that it might slip through all of us if under this current administration, the whole STEM research that we collaborate overseas.
Right. Yeah, we've seen people coming back to ACT UP, myself included, since the last fall's election with the new Trump era upon us. Andy, can you describe the march? What happened there?
Well, the march, which was led by people who are more physically impaired than others, because one of the things we've learned is about consideration of all the needs, the different needs that people have. And we marched across from the memorial area to the ghost of St. Vincent's, which is now this mega condo, and paused there to say some words about it. It was so disgusting what they did, closing that hospital down. Really unforgivable. I would never want to live in that building. Bad karma. Then we turned and headed up to 14th Street, walked across 14th Street, chanting lots of posters, and at Union Square we gathered, and there were a number of speakers. I do want to mention something, and again, Ivy mentioned about Reed Freeland speaking at the memorial, and Reed became active in ACT UP about 3 or 4 years ago. He works at Housing Works. He's just a great guy, and there is nothing more powerful than when someone speaks from their own experience openly. And he talked about the difference between how he felt about being HIV positive since he was a child, and what a change it made when he was influenced by other people and began to realize he had nothing to be ashamed about, and that he had, there was a real contribution he could make. And I don't know who may be listening today who may not ever have been active in any way with ACT UP and in fighting the epidemic, to end the epidemic. But one of the things that I learned is, whoever you are, whatever your background, whether you're HIV positive or not, you can make a contribution to ending this epidemic. Come to our meetings, listen to what's going on, and join us. We need you.
Great. Well, unfortunately, we're coming up on the closing of this interview, so we'll have to have you and others back to talk more, because we didn't get nearly to all the stuff I wanted to cover. But, you know, ACT UP lives on, and so does this radio show, and we continue to do work. So ACT UP meetings are every Monday evening at the LGBT Community Center in Manhattan. It's at 208 West 13th Street at 7 p.m. All are welcome to come and join us. There are work groups and committees and so forth you can get involved with. So, again, we've been getting a bit of an update and pausing for a moment to take a look at the ACT UP movement, which really became worldwide, chapters all over the place in the heyday.
Say at the end of our actions, ACT UP, fight back, end AIDS.
That's right. That's the chant. So, thank you. We've been speaking with Andy Velez and Ivy Arce, both members of ACT UP New York, as am myself. Thanks for joining us here on Health Action. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this interview. I'm Mark Hanna.
You're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Health Action. Stay tuned for a brief promo on an upcoming Earth Day event, followed by segment 2 with Catherine Davis. Today is Saturday, April 22nd, and it's Planet Heart's 10th anniversary of World Peace Earth Day, celebrating our planet, healing our heart. A conscious spiritual community gathering in unity with special presenters that will honor our Earth and New Earth with inspirational talks, live music, performances, and ceremony. That's Saturday, April 22nd, from 6:30 p.m. sharp to 10 p.m. at the Church of St. Paul and St. Andrew, 263 West 86th Street at the corner of West End Avenue. Doors open at 6 p.m. For details and information, go to www.planetheart.org or call 212-222-5432.
In this next segment, I want to talk about something that I experienced over the last couple of days. I had gone out of town to do a presentation, and afterwards I went into a meditation, because these kind of things can be a little bit stressful on the body, so I wanted to relax. But as I went into this meditation, I began to see something that was much greater. I felt a real illumination in terms of having this vision, in part, of what's going on with each of us in humanity at this time. And I've spoken about this a number of times, about this evolutionary process that we are engaged in, and that is part of a much greater cosmic evolutionary process in terms of the time frame of our existence and the transformation from one epoch to another. The indigenous people of Mexico and South America, I think, call it the dawn. I believe the dawn of the sixth sun. So it's like we're in a new evolutionary process. We're seeing the chaos of that evolutionary process. And so it's really very important for us to be proactive with ourselves, with our bodies, with our mind, with our spirit, so that we can remain strong and stay on point. And it's really important that we recognize that a lot of what we may be experiencing internally, within our emotions, you know, perhaps feelings of depression, perhaps feelings of hopelessness. And in our bodies, we are feeling very often different kinds of aches and pains or ailments and things basically sprouting up in unexpected ways. And we're also seeing this series of events in the political discourse in which there's a great deal of chaos and controversy. But at this moment, I really want to speak to the personal impact. Because of this nature of what's happening in the world, the chaos and the uprooting of old energies, that just as we're seeing chaos politically, there's a way in which this chaos is being reflected in our physical bodies. And what I was able to see during this meditation is that we have overlaid within our bodies a matrix system. I know a lot of people talk about the matrix in terms of the control mechanisms of our world, but we don't always fully appreciate how deeply that control matrix has been embedded into our physical, psycho-spiritual structures. And when I saw this particular vision of it, I saw that we have within us a sort of a false matrix system that is square. It's boxy. And so if you were to imagine a box that extends from the front of your shoulders to the back of your shoulders, and from the shoulders down to the level of our hips and the level of the the pelvic region, but it goes down to either side of the hips and moves to the front. And within this box are a series of matrix lines. And, you know, it's a cross-hatching that flows through our body. It's in, flows up through the neck and head, through the arms, through the legs. And so what it is doing is imposing an unnatural structure on our natural physicality structures, which are more spiral in nature, which are more flowing in nature. So if you think of the meridians in the Chinese medicine system or the mapping of the prana system, you'll see that there are lines of energies that flow through our body, flow through various organs, move through the arms and the legs to create this natural synergy within our own body so that we can have a real sense of what's going on within us. But this matrix system that has been in many ways embedded in our structure, these boxy lines and matrices are what have been interrupting our natural flow and our natural capacity to heal and evolve. And one of the things, the ways that they have been embedded, well, there are many ways. Some of them are just through the ancestral lineage, because a lot of the things that are going on now have been going on for generations. So it comes through, has emerged through the embedding within the DNA structure. It also emerges through, has been reinforced through the kind of media that we have, the kind of stress that we live under, you know, being having the need to eternally live in this survival mode. So these structures are there, this energetic structure is there, and what happens is that the energy from this structure begins to move out like a dark cloud or a dark smoke, and I was able to see that it flows in through the lungs to shut down the breathing capacity, to impede one's ability to move through the emotions. It sort of circles into the solar plexus and begins to muddy the field of the solar plexus so that we can't process and get in contact with our authentic power. And it flows down into the root of our body through the root chakras and through the solar plexus region to, in a way, disconnect us from the power of our earth. And going up, it also flows into the mind and serves to sustain thoughts, you know, random thoughts, repetitive thoughts that don't seem to really be coming from yourself, from us, but they just seem to be programmed in this energy of self-doubt, this energy of self-blame, this energy of conflict. So I think it's important first for us to recognize that we're dealing with something that has, that is having an impact on our lives, but is not truly the essence of who we are. So as I began to see this internalized structure, I began to realize that we need to have a specific technique that will allow us to move this energy out of our body. And so this is a basic Qigong exercise that one would do in the normal course of the practice, and it includes a remedy routine that is part of the soaring crane system, in which we discharge negative energies from our body into the earth, and the earth has the capacity to break up that energy and turn it into mulch, so it returns it to the source so that it can be reapplied in a positive way. But this is something that really needs to be done on a fairly regular basis. If you're finding that you're having some of these issues that you want to work with, or maybe there are some of these intractable things that you've been dealing with that keep coming back, or things that that just feel very stubborn. And if you're dealing with some of these emotional, psychological issues that seem to keep you in a state where you just feel underwater, where you feel overwhelmed, that this is a remedy that you can do in the moment. You know, you can, you know, take a little break, go to another room, go to the bathroom, go to a park, and just take the opportunity to do a cleanse. It's very, it's not long, but it is specific. And so what I want to do is to just talk you through what we're going to do so that if you like, you can take notes or you can come back and listen to the archive and take notes so that you will be able to create for yourself this little ritual that will be an immediate remedy as you want to recover from a particular situation, but also over time, if you're persistent, it will begin to drain the energy of this matrix, inner embedded matrix. It will drain it out of your system. So I want you to restart this process by engaging with the energy fields of the body. And in Qigong practice, we have three primary energy fields. They're called Dan Tiens, which in translation means elixir field. And the Dan Tiens are what distribute the energy throughout the body. They maintain the life force, they maintain the heart consciousness, and they maintain the divine consciousness within our bodies. So the lower Dan Tien is in the lower abdomen, below the navel. The middle Dan Tien is in the field of your heart, in the center of your chest. And the upper Dan Tien encompasses the mind. It's beyond the physical brain. It includes all levels of the mind. As the heart Dan Tien is, surrounds the body, but also is a quantum field that goes deep within the self and connects you to your higher awareness. And the lower Dan Tien, which is in the lower abdomen, connects you to the earth and connects you to your being as a living divine body upon the earth. And it also holds the vital life force, which is your life force energy, the energy that fuels the eternal. So the way the system works in Chinese medicine is that your energy flows in a natural flow, flowing up the back of the body through the governor vessel, up to the top of our head, which is the connection to divinity, and down the front of the body. And it is an ongoing internal flow in this circle. And from this inner orbit, the chi circulates into the meridians, flowing to bring healthy energy to your organ systems, as well as to your emotional systems and your mental systems. And this natural flow is what is being interrupted by the embedded matrix that we have in our bodies. So we start this process by bringing our attention to the energy of our lower Dan Tien in the lower abdomen and collect into the lower Dan Tien all of our own energy, all of our own energy flow, the power of that energy, and calling back the energy that is lost, that may be distracted or refracted from our field with our intent. We can call it back. And then we circulate with our mind, bringing this energy down to the bottom of our torso, connecting to the earth, then bringing it up through our back to the top of our neck, really, to the base of our skull, and allowing that energy to flow up into the skull, the upper, to flow down through our shoulders and arms into the palms of our hands. In the palms of our hands, the center of our hands, we have an energy portal, which many energy healers use to do hands-on healing, but everyone can learn to do this. In this exercise, however, we're going to lift our palms upward and then allow that energy to flow into our palms, creating a ball of radiant light. And then as we can extend our arms out in front of us, and we extend our own ball of light into the field in front of us, allowing it to be reinforced, the earth sending energy to reinforce, the cosmos sending energy to reinforce, so that you have this sort of triple enforced field ball of energy resting in your palms. And then we lift that energy up in front of us, bringing it back up towards the upper head. So we want to lift the ball above our heads and then guide this energy down, allowing it flow down through the cosmic, divine, and human mind. But what we're going to do is to place our fingertips on the top of our shoulders. So you put your fingertips right at the joint at that. You want to be on the inside of that joint, closer between that and the neck. And then we're going to guide that energy and allow it to flow through our fingertips down into our body. And from the shoulders is where we have this anchoring point of the embedded energetic matrix, and you're just going to send that energy in a straight line all the way down through the torso, sending it down in through the hips, and then sending it down through the legs, into our feet, and from our toes, especially the big toe, just send that disturbance deep into the earth. And just take a few moments to allow the energy and visualize as you're doing it a stream of light flowing down through your body. And as it's flowing down, it's taking on this boxy energy and dissolving those matrix structures, taking away the anchors primarily, and sending that anchored destructive energy into the earth. And as that energy begins to be released from your body, it will drag with it some of these other cloud-like energies that have flown into your lungs and into your solar plexus and into the lower abdomen, will begin to dissipate and flow into the earth along with your stream of energy. So the idea is to allow your light to flow through your body and extend into the earth, keeping your light, but just allow your light to push. You could visualize it as a fog or a dark cloud, and just push that out with your light into the earth. And as you're working with this movement, with this exercise, I want you to breathe gently. You know, just allow your breaths to be gentle and allow your awareness to be very clear of your intent that you are disintegrating and releasing this toxic structure from your body and returning it into the earth where it can be mulched back into useful energy. And then giving yourself a little bit of time to be passive with the earth and offer gratitude to the earth, to the cosmos for clearing and transforming this energy. And then just allow your, gently lower your hands, bringing them down to the lower abdomen. And then once again, call your clean, clear, vibrant energy back into the lower dantian. And you can visualize in your lower abdomen that there is a sun, a beautiful sun, glowing. You could visualize the rising sun. And just allowing that energy, your own clean energy, to be returned to the vitality, your life force energy. And then when you're done, you can just rub your hands together. And if you like, you can put your hands on your chest over the heart and just offer gratitude to yourself and love and appreciation for your being and recognition of your divinity and connection to Source. And that will be enough to begin this whole process of clearing the backlog that we're working with at this time during this transitional evolutionary period. And I went through that a little bit fast because I wanted to make sure to get the whole procedure in for you so that you could come back and take a look at it. But you want to, as going into it, as you proceed with the process, allow yourself to become calm, allow your breath to become calm, and just do the visualization and the movements, and it will do a lot towards clearing the stagnant energy and building your vitality and your life force energy going forward. And you'll be able to have a clearer mind, body, and spirit, because you will be releasing not only from yourself these toxic structures, your work will also contribute to the whole of the human family, as what you're doing also has an impact, as always, on everyone else.
This has been Health Action. I'm Catherine Davis. For those of you who'd like to be in touch or find out more about what you've heard during today's program, you can contact me at heartofmindradio@gmail.com, or you can visit my website, qigongonline.net, qigongonline.net. Take good care and join in again next week. And stay tuned, coming up, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
देखो बिना फल ना परत है, तुम देखो बिना कल ना परत है, जान तुम्हारी छा तेरे मेरे जन्म मरण के साथी
up, sweetheart. If you board that plane without making a donation to WBAI, one of these days you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. WBAI is the only station with the guts and determination to seriously challenge this nightmare Trump. The rest of the media are cowards. It's the voice of the poor, oppressed, downtrodden, and the imprisoned. You know, Rick, this fella Trump is bad news. He's worse than Major Strasser. Act occasionally. Why don't you make a donation? I already did at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Lori and I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Hey, Maya, guess what? Kylie Jenner's new lip kit is out.
Mercedes, are you really going to spend your money on that garbage?
It's not garbage. She finally released a color I've been looking for, ginger.
Mercedes, you can do so much more.
Like what?
You can donate it to WBAI and become a BAI buddy.
What's a BAI buddy?
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a monthly donation to WBAI. Once you join, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a free... You can sign up at WB.
Well, assuming we can get this console to work, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program. I still almost always say Saturday. A weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview with David Gerwig recorded last week. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It'd be, I think, very easy to look at the new film, The Discovery, and think that Netflix, where the film is running, saw The Arrival and said, ooh, we gotta get a piece of that introspective sci-fi stuff, and then whomped up this in response. I don't think that really happened. The release dates are too close together, for one thing. And I don't think Netflix plays that kind of game, although maybe this came in as a film that was already in existence, and Netflix saw it as an easy way to tap into that market. I don't know for sure.
We are recording, but before we begin, I will explain that this is not just the, obviously, GOH speech, but this is also a radio.
Okay, I beg your pardon. But I don't know what I did. This one was, I think, human error, where we moved from one thing to another. Aha, okay. I pulled a flash drive out. Aha. And I thought I was playing Dan's movie review from that from the flash drive. Darn it. No, I didn't. I bleeped up. I what's the number? I number threed up. I threed up, for those who are familiar with the alleged seven words, which have nothing to do with the FCC. The third word. I threed up, and it really twos me off. So, I apologize. The problem with the volume levels, that was not me. That was somebody threeing our console here. But cutting off Dan Persons there, that was totally my fault and error. And I am going to start that review from the beginning. So that you can follow the flow, follow the discovery of working in radio, and I have still not yet earned $100.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It'd be, I think, very easy to look at the new film, The Discovery, and think that Netflix, where the film is running, saw The Arrival and said, ooh, we got to get a piece of that introspective sci-fi stuff, and then whomped up this in response. I don't think that really happened. The release dates are too close together for one thing, and I don't think Netflix plays that kind of game, although maybe this came in as a film that was already in existence, and Netflix saw it as an easy way to tap into that market. I don't know for sure. At the very least, you can see the two films as spiritual cousins, which makes for some interesting contrasts. The Arrival, about a group of linguists trying to communicate with an alien species, was based on an actual SF novella and paid respect to the scientific process and the people who worked within it.
Okay, this time I'm pausing it because I think this time for sure Dan said The Arrival. Name of the movie, for the record, is Arrival. There is no, what's the word? There's no article before that, just like my show is Hour of the Wolf and not The Hour of the Wolf. Also named, by the way, after a movie.
The Discovery, written by its director Charlie McDowell and his collaborator Justin Later, about a scientist played by Robert Redford who discovers proof of an afterlife, or at least that something escapes a dying body and goes elsewhere, is a little dodgier in its premise and the repercussions thereof. No specific science or scientific-sounding double talk is cited, which would be okay, I can roll with that, but what tests my credibility is that the film suggests that, in reaction, people start offing themselves in great, whopping numbers in the hopes of moving on to something better. Now, after the results of the 2016 election, I've had to revise my estimation of the depth of human stupidity. But even after that, I can't envision, even with the presumably ironclad scientific proof that the Discovery suggests has been revealed, that humanity would be inclined to begin a great lemming-like leap over the precipice. Maybe I'm too optimistic. In the hands of an Ionesco or the Firesign Theater, which actually did something like this in their album Everything You Know Is Wrong, this would be the setting for some brutal farce. But McDowell has settled on a tone of quiet melancholy, as if this sort of behavior is worthy of bittersweet empathy on our part. The actual story is about the son of the scientist, played by Jason Segel, who rescues a woman, played by Rooney Mara, attempting to transition, and then brings her to join his father on an isolated estate as he and a small group of acolytes attempt to develop a technology to reveal where all those disembodied spirits are going. This in many ways feels like one of Wim Wenders' forays into genre, more about the personalities, particularly the budding romance between Segel and Mara, than the premise, especially as the story takes a more metaphysical turn toward the end, and a key revelation is dropped about why Segel's character has decided to reunite with his father at this particular moment in time. There's some nice stuff in that twist, even though I figured out what the film's afterlife actually is near the start of the film. And it would have more power if the Discovery's world was more in line with something that reflected actual human behavior. As it is, the film is an emotional journey that falters on a number of false steps. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Talking here with Matt of WBAI about various things. Life, the universe, and everything. And sort of losing track. Most of this program is pre-recorded. The main segment, which is about to come, runs an hour and 32 minutes, and I'm going to have to pay attention to that because there are naughty words. Now, we are within what is called safe harbor, and we are, in fact, allowed to use such language in an artistic context. But this is not that. This is actually just in the course of a conversation. And under a proper understanding of FCC rules and regulations, which, by the way, are always cited as being law, they are not. They are rules and regulations by which you hold a license in the public trust. the FCC is not illegal. They don't make laws. They have rules. And they can say, well, we can take away your license. You see? It's a different thing. Well, there are driving laws with licenses and like that. But anyway, that's all pedantic. Doesn't matter. What matters is that I know when I can say boo and when not. If we're in the course of a short story, it's perfectly all right for somebody to say, boy, did I number three up.